Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, this is Harvey.
Hello, Harvey. My name is Wesley. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Dave. How's everybody going?
Feeling good.
Great. Well, don't let me interrupt good gossip if you guys are already started.
We didn't get to the gossip yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now that what you heard last time is kind of marinated for a week, what are your thoughts and reflections on that? And I know it's a lot of material, and that's always my kind of conundrum. I would much more prefer a seminar style, but yet there's so much information I want to convey to you, and that's why we make it available on recording so you can go back. But are there, you know, thoughts or questions you have in reflecting on it or ideas you'd like to explore?
Well,
I mean, this is Harvey again. I just thought the idea
welcome,
of, you know. Sorry?
I said welcome. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I thought the idea of connecting with people from the inside out is really powerful. I have typically been more of a, like a facts and numbers kind of guy. But that doesn't really work in sales, I guess. The idea of connecting with people from the inside out seems to resonate as a more effective approach.
Well, try it and see. And I think it works across the board. Whatever your service or your product is, it works for professionals. And that's why I'm especially I especially wanted to present it to you as I assume most of you are coaches. It's something that I wanted to learn because of it was the area of the mind and brain science, which is one of my passions and applications and expertise, that I wanted to apply in this way, both for myself and my colleagues, because I think there's a great deal that we can learn from that. So I would say try it and see what works. You know, do it in the scientific method. Try it, see what it works, see if it's replicable. Try something else, see what it works, and keep an open mind about it, about not the story you want to believe, but the feedback you actually get, and see what works the best, because that's something we always want to do in going forward is to really understand what works the best and how we can be of greatest help to people and how we can really engage them to create a meaningful engagement and conversation that will make a difference for the rest of their lives. I mean, I really believe that with clients, that when we really do what we can do with a client, it will make a difference for the rest of that client's life. So this is one way to do it, and it's a way to be sure that we are initially engaging with someone to know some of the principles that work and which ones don't. So, Harvey, has there been anything that's been particularly different than your usual practice from what you've heard?
Like I said, I've tended to approach people from more of a number, you know, like a facts and costs and benefits and that kind of thing. And I'm, you know, uh-huh. just kind of, you know, dawning on me that I need to try a different approach. And I'm doing some other things on the side, getting some other coaching and things, and they're all pointing in the same direction, which is, you know, I really need to connect with people and their needs and what's important to them and their problems and how we can, you know, maybe help them solve them. But, you know, connecting with the people is the common denominator there.
Exactly. I think that's very true. Now, in life coaching, we may have a somewhat different framework as executive coaching in terms of an approach. Common to both is what we've been talking about, but with life coaching, we may approach much more through a right brain access, and in executive coaching, depending on who you're dealing with, if you're dealing with a corporation, you may have to be able to talk about the things that you talk about, return on investment and that sort of thing. But you still want to know, even with an organization, you know, what's your greatest challenge? What do you have in place, and what do you need? So when you get answers to those three questions, ask separately and waiting for a response, that can be useful to you in offering a possibility of what you may do to help someone bridge a gap, because that's exactly what we do. You ask, you know, what's the greatest challenge you have in your life or your business? And they tell you, and that happens to be exactly what we do as mentor coaches.
Right. Right.
So great point there. Thanks. And I think you're right about an approach, even though it may need to be framed differently in different settings and who you're dealing with, but some of the principles are there, and principles that we've talked about, and we're going to expand that to look at the neuroscience of persuasion to add to that in our seminar today.
Okay, great.
Any other thoughts or reflections or questions?
No, I'm good. I was just when you went over the information last week, I was noticing the patterns between things that I read and information you presented, and I love that, because one of the things that was of interest to me, especially with the two quiz questions, was that they both reflected on confidence from us for what we do to help clients. Then also the why of what, you know, what we're doing, what distinguishes us from everyone else, or the why for the, or, you know, what issues the client might have, and then using that to help us out. So I was very fascinated, and I love that. So I'm very excited for today.
Thank you. Is this Brian?
This is Wesley.
Wesley, okay, super. All right, well, great, thanks.
Absolutely.
Any other comments or questions before we move into the material? Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that, and that's very helpful to me as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I will save some time. I'm almost certain if I don't get strung out on my stories. Again, this is in your on your outline. I'm going from that outline. I'm just going to elaborate on it, and let's see where we are. So hang on. So we're talking, as I mentioned, in our seminar today on the neuroscience of persuasion. So look at your outline, and there are two quizzes to begin. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities: receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, eating a favorite food. Now, a hint, one of these was endorsed as much as all other four combined. It's the one that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers. The answer, the students valued boosts to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than all the other experiences combined. Four, and remember, we discussed just briefly, the reason that we do what we do is because we imagine how it's going to make us feel. And that feeling, when it's generated internally, one from esteem, trumps every, let me use a different term, post-election, overrides every other experience in terms of motivation. Quiz number four. The American Sociological Review studied the hiring practices of three elite industries, law, investment banking, management consulting firms, to determine the primary criteria they use for those qualified to make the final round of interviews. In other words, what really worked and determined it, no matter what the theories were. So what do you think it was? Intellectual prestige, the degree obtained, GPA, sharing similar experiences as the interviewer, expertise in the specific area or position sought, and recommendations by other people. Same with purchase decisions. We buy what fits our identity. we hire those who we identify with, sharing similar experiences with the interviewer, became more important than any one of the others. So persuasion simply means the process of getting your prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling or state with your product or service. Now, again, all of this has to be authentic. It has to be a true value. We're talking about just building a bridge. People buy people to connect to a person that they know, like, and trust. Let me give you an illustration of this. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. We went to the city close to the farm outside the little town where I live. We looked at coats at three stores, Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask, because that's all there was. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, and seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You kind of pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look good in that coat." Now, nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was a coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. So I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like the coat, but I really liked the salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I could not grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So for persuasion, let's first talk about the art and neuroscience of explanation. Now, we all to some degree have to overcome the curse of knowledge, the difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. And this is the killer pairing, combined with wanting to share all of what we know. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge that we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, will interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and communicate in a simple, clear, succinct way. And remember, if information were enough, if information would change behavior, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved for the future, and a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. So here are some ideas about explanations distilled from a number of neuroscience studies, the neuroscience studies of explanations for impact and retention. Now, this is a very brief overview, then we're going to incorporate them in the principles of persuasion. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what problem you address, then the benefits you bring. If it's a presentation, state your intentions early. This frames listening to prepare an audience for an explanation. Listen carefully. People give clues throughout a conversation that we can miss if we're thinking about what we're going to say next. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. Keep it short. When you speak to others, they're only going to be able to fully process and recall about 10 to 12 words before their retention begins to slip. The principle of brevity is hard to adhere to because we usually think we have to explain everything if the other person's going to possibly understand us. So we usually speak too fast, use too many words, both of which eclipse the understanding and retention of the other person. Remember, we talked before, the brain has the capacity to really retain 10 to 12 words, and then it begins to fade a bit. So anything beyond that is too much for the other person's brain to respond, process, and recall in a really full and complete way. And we need perhaps at times to ask if the other person understands what we just said. Another, and this is an elaboration of what I said, to speak more briefly with power, clarity, and persuasiveness, consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Mark Waldman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using the 10-10 principle. Hold your hands up in front of you. Make a fist with both hands. Raise one finger every time you speak a word. When you run out of fingers, you stop speaking. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity. Especially think about fashioning your questions to your clients in this way. Mark's research showed that charged situations like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration resolved faster, averaging 20 to 25% of the usual time when they used this method, when both sides agreed to do the 10-10, and reached significantly more satisfying and complete conclusions. He describes this and some related aspects in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain, and I would recommend that for coaches. Another, reduce noise. Include only what's simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct, and then pause. Give your client a chance to respond. Don't elaborate or explain or stack on another question or explain it. Use visuals. Many people are visual learners. Visuals can capture and captivate an audience in a way that words may not be able to. Match the medium and the message. For example, a cooking show on the radio is a mismatch. Embrace imperfection. Be more concerned about substance and understanding than polished design and perfection. Slow down. Be accessible. And finally, have fun. States of mind are contagious. If you're having fun, your listener, your audience will too, most likely, if you take them with you. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So here are six principles of persuasion. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain. And social psychology and recently neuroscience studies have identified six basic principles of persuasion. First principle, liking. We like people who like us. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know and like and who are like us. So the application here, discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. I want to tell you a Magic Johnson story. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching them, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets, two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game with me, and we had dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were each excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. Notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially how he relates to everybody on the court. After the game, and each in turn, I ask them what they notice and to not tell the other the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the other team players. What else, I asked. And they added the referees. Anything else? I kept nudging them because I knew they knew enough about the game. They each mentioned some aspect of how much he actually fouled, but then he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides and the referees especially liked him. And he genuinely seemed to like them. He was having fun, and they were too. He was an expert at handling relationships as much as he was handling the ball. And they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that they participated in that success if they had to break that flow and call a foul and disrupt that state of good energy experience with it. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they are more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to share our sense of what's important, our priorities. So it becomes important to establish commonalities that may not immediately be visible by specifically addressing these values. We prefer to say yes to the request of someone we know and like. This simple principle is used in hundreds of ways by total strangers to get us to comply with their request. Remember the slightly embarrassed kid who looked like a blue marshmallow in cold weather? So let's deconstruct this. The crucial question here, what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? One, the halo effect. The halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples, kindness, honesty, intelligence. We are always teaching people how to respond to us. Another, similarity. We like people who are similar to us. Similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, who I'm going to quote in our final seminar, talked about this when he was my expert content contributor at my mastermind group recently, and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him, not consciously. Another compliment. The guy who's known as the greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was really liking clients. Each month, he sends every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message, and the message hardly varies. It reads, "I like you." And people who knew him said he authentically meant it, and he keeps up with each person. And a final, contact and cooperation. For the most part, we like things that are familiar to us. By providing people with different backgrounds, with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to connect with others. A study in Edinburgh placed hundreds of wallets on busy streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, an elderly couple. Other wallets had no photo at all. The percent of wallets that were returned: with the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With an elderly couple, 28%. With no photo, barely double digits. 1 in 7 were returned. Our brains are wired to connect emotionally with others. The second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. The application, give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. People return favors. When we help people, they will want to help us. It induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. When you behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Well, of course, that's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelms other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who received a free Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the prior favor. You know, think of the address labels you get as a gift with a request for a donation. Third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others. Especially in ambiguous situations, we do things we see other people doing especially when those other people seem similar to us. So one application, use peer power whenever it's possible of your peers. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct and popular or what's unacceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others doing it. Like other tools of influence, it's a convenient shortcut for determining how we behave. We assume an action is more correct if others are doing it. When I'm invited to a function that I'm not certain about the dress, I'll call someone I know who's attending and ask, "Are you wearing a tux or a suit?" Then I at least know one other person will be dressed like me. Another illustration. Bartenders salt tip jars with a few dollar bills at the beginning of the evening to simulate tips left by prior clients to give the impression that tipping with folding money is proper behavior. Here's a study that really demonstrates this. This was in San Diego. Researchers hung four flyers on doorknobs in various neighborhoods. And they were all controlled and matched for, you know, socioeconomic and other kind of variables. One flyer told homeowners they should conserve energy because it helped the environment. Another said saving energy was socially responsible. Another said it saved money. The fourth flyer said the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it. The researcher found that the houses with the fourth flyer, the majority of neighbors in the community are doing it, showed more change than all three others combined. Simply urging people or telling them that it's a good idea to recycle or it saves money, those were the least effective. Another extensive study showed this contagion effect in everyday life to examine the amount of food eaten in different contexts. At restaurants, on average, subjects ate, and listen to this, alone the least amount, with one other person 35% more, in a party of four 75% more, and a party of seven or more 96% more. When we're uncertain and the situation is unclear or unambiguous, we look around at other people as points of reference to see how they're reacting, or I guess eating. Successful influence is governed more by context than cognition. This is the power of testimonials of previous users or clients or esteemed figures. An example, for an event that you want to influence attendance, first invite the people who are most likely to attend anyway. Then, to the next group of people, emphasize how the first group has already responded. The fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made. So the application here, write down and publicly declare a commitment. We're then more likely to follow through. Remember what we do at the end of each coaching session, to ask what the client commits to do before we meet again. Here's a practical example of how you can get clients to more consistently follow through on a commitment for an initial appointment. A series of experiments were conducted at three busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time and a standard appointment-making call, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through. A variation had an even greater effect. It was for the receptionist to simply ask the patient to write down the time and date of the next appointment on the card. The result was an 18% reduction in no-shows for that group. There's less commitment when someone else writes out the plan or the time, including something as simple as an appointment time. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it's more productive to get a response such as an email to simply check yes to confirm an appointment. This enhances commitment and follow-through rates. These are all ways to help people begin to take ownership of their own story. They've taken ownership of that time when they say it or write it. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. So once we've made a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, a confirmation bias, because we cherry-pick data that will support it, and selectively omit data that will refute it, inattention blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision and are consistent with it. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. This principle is fundamental to our motivation to maintain the status quo, the default mode, the continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. So we need simply to find ways for this principle to benefit our clients and us. So let's elaborate a little bit more about this. There are two factors that are at play in maintaining a status quo and not changing. That would include things like in not scheduling a time with you or not accepting your invitation or your recommendation for a professional appointment. One, automatic responding in this way to not change, to maintain the status quo, offers a shortcut through the confusion and the enormity of daily life. We simply don't have to expend the mental energy to weigh pros and cons or make tough decisions, but just resort to the default mode, to consistently responding the same way we always have. Automatic consistency offers us a way to avoid the rigors of continuing deliberation. And repetition can masquerade as effectiveness when we know the outcome. Two, we avoid the work of initiating a new action by continuing the same one. Now, think about, you've all participated in this in some way, I'll bet. Continuity programs utilize this characteristic. You give your credit card number to sign up for 3 free months of the subscription. You're charged beginning in the 4th month unless you unsubscribe. It's a continuity. Status quo has it, then, 82% of people do not initiate another action of unsubscribing but maintain the consistency of the subscription. As many as 62% of those keeping their subscriptions do not read them, but they haven't unsubscribed because that takes a separate initiative. Automatic consistency and maintenance of the status quo is a shield against further thought and deliberation. How can you make positive use of this consistency principle in your business then? To obtain a large purchase, start with a very small one. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a couple of bucks, because the purpose of the initial small transaction is not profit, but commitment to introduce yourself and your benefits to a client to begin a relationship. Further purchases, including progressively larger ones, flow naturally from this commitment. This small initial purchase converts a prospect into a client. The fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The application, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. And when you need someone to advance your case or product or service, having an agent or advocate can be very helpful so you don't have to do it yourself. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone else is advocating for you. This is the authority principle in action. It's an application of the halo effect. This is the idea behind things like book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. And an application here, when you negotiate with an organization, first develop an internal champion within the organization who advocates and provides information. The sixth persuasion principle, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. The application here highlights unique benefits and exclusive information. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. G.K. Chesterton said it very simply, the way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Let me give you an example. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. Well, there were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit. But Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of the coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Now, Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears, even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it becomes more valuable, enhancing desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only 2 left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more. Mimetic desire, in other words, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more value the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. This scarcity principle involves a secondary source of power. As opportunities become less available, we actually lose freedom and choice, and we hate to lose the freedom and choice we already have, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. Daniel Kahneman at Princeton won a Nobel Prize by showing that if you want to mobilize people under conditions of uncertainty, losing something has twice the impact than the gain of that same object or amount. Remember, we discussed loss aversion in the previous seminar. Losing $100 is twice as painful as gaining $100. So we need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what might be lost or foregone if someone does not act or purchase. So when increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react by trying to possess that item even more than before. Now, a related tendency is to want what has been banned and to presume that it's more worthwhile when it's limited. The scarcity principle works for messages, communications, and knowledge, and that we valued limited or exclusive information. Louis Neiser said, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. After I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited, shortly after that, to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject. subject I chose. And that was usually saved as a plum position because it was so much fun. I was warned, though, not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was between 4 and 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there was not enough registration or no registration. So the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate that there was a maximum of 12 seats available. And my purpose was to ensure optimum discussion. I didn't think about this, at least consciously at the time. I didn't know this principle. I was an optimist. I didn't know consciously the scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up and the waiting list grew. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic. To genuinely have your client's best interest at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. Now, let's look at persuasion science, why we buy. People will buy your product or service when they feel pressure. There are two kinds of pressure. External pressure from the outside, such as marketing or sales information. Internal pressure created from inside by an innate desire. Of the two, internal pressure and internal rewards are way more powerful since people buy for their own reasons. People buy wants first, needs later. From social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing or actually motivating principles of the brain to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure are overarching. They're hardwired into the brain. If we associate positive emotions or rewards, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. If someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and the pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. A master formula for persuasion, then, to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. People will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. This is the risk aversion principle. Therefore, we need to sell consequences, positive consequences if they do, to point out the negative consequences if they don't, and to think about how much of what we do is designed to prevent pain, paying taxes, paying bills, exercising, maintaining your house and car. Our brains are hardwired to prioritize survival over improvement, to prevent pain more so than to seek pleasure. This means that our brains are not necessarily a mechanism designed for success, fulfillment, or growth, but for survival, for the immediacy of avoiding pain or gaining pleasure. This is where our minds have to take over, to make plans, to create maps. Three steps, and these are three important steps in this whole area of persuasion. Now, remember the three building blocks of compelling stories? Challenge, struggle, and resolution. These three building blocks are common to all successful stories, from effective marketing to best-selling novels and films. So, these three steps. One, find the challenge, the problem, or the pain. Find the deep want or interest that's not fulfilled, what someone wants but they're not getting. This is an individual or a corporation. What they will not be able to do or be themselves. The foundation of effective selling is to first highlight the challenge or the unmet need the problem, the pain. Two, illuminate the struggle. Crystallize awareness by asking questions. Motivators are all emotional. Clarify and define them by focus by asking questions about potential motivation. Do you want to have the best? Or at least have these in mind in what you're doing. You may not ask this question, obviously, but to have the best, to be smarter, to be confident, to have the most successful practice. These are things, these are questions that may be unstated, but you're orienting responses such as benefits to. Three, point to the resolution. Show them how to solve the challenge, how to heal their discomfort by using your product or service. The mind and brain both seek closure. So you help your client succinctly and accurately associate a desired feeling or state with your product or service. Make it compelling and real. They will then authentically associate buying with pleasure and not buying with pain. We want emotionally, but we justify it logically. Find the emotional reason, their reason, to buy now. Strategies that simply point to features or benefits or inform people about making a change are usually not going to work. It's not information that leads people to make decisions. People don't buy products. They buy states of mind. Whatever we associate to something determines our behavior. To change behavior, change the associative link. Link the message to a fundamental human emotion. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. The most significant thing that great influencers and persuaders understand and communicate is this. It's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question. What is it you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. Lincoln would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and establish his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. When he then presented his client's side, he established that as well and in detail. People then listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he has to be honest and speaking from his heart. An effective way to be positively and gently persuasive to win someone over by pointing out their side of the story. Discover and vocalize their point of view to show them not only you understand their view, but you get how it makes sense. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. That may be simply to resonate with their doubt or their uncertainty or their trepidation about spending that much money. Now, we've discussed the six principles of persuasion. This bridges to the four primary tools of persuasion. One is relatedness and connection. For long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that sense of caring, of connection. Remember the two initial quizzes this seminar. Empathy is the ability to resonate with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, and ways of constructing meaning. That person's subjective reality, in other words. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step. To empathically resonate with someone and build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you attempted to understand their experience and they'll correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of initial effectiveness, to be understood. Remember how an experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. An experiment was done with a team of British physicians in which they reminded their patients to attend their next appointment when the patient's first name was used in the reminder versus a reminder without the name. It led to a 57% reduction in the rate of no-shows. Now, this sounds kind of gimmicky, but when it's done authentically, someone will really know. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy, having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of significance, to feel important, unique, effective. This is one of the six basic human needs. When you understand what people believe and how they make decisions, you can then show them how buying your product or service is consistent with their beliefs. This is the essence of selling, a non-salesy selling. To find their challenges, discover their beliefs and motivations of what they need and that you can provide, show you care, and then determine focus by stating not only the questions, but your recommendations. Third tool of persuasion, certainty, another human basic need. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think simply about how we repeat patterns. We listen to the same music. We go back to the places we've been. We order the same food. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the error detection mechanism, which is one reason we avoid and resist change. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. For example, much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition. A tool of persuasion comes from feeling certain about what you're saying. The person who feels most certain is the greatest influencer. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind. Every state of mind is contagious. So these three primary tools of persuasion are synonymous with three of the six basic human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management. This is so important, we're going to have most of another seminar address this. Manage your emotions and state of mind. One all-pro cornerback I work with used this focus statement, reset after every play. Focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate states of mind. We're going to come back to this. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking questions is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We're going to talk a lot more about this in Seminar 3. So this is simply an application here. Let's, in summary, apply these tools and principles. Three initial questions from the point of view of the client, that to have these in mind, that the client will be asking these questions. What's in it for me? What is it? Can you prove it? Also consider, from the point of view of the client, these questions. What will it give me that I want and need? Will it be worth it? Will I be able to justify it? And do I need it now? So, your unique position. Consider these questions from your point of view. What do you do uniquely well better than anybody else? What skills do you have that people find interesting and ask you about? When people refer business to you, what do they tell others about you? If you're not sure, ask them. You may be surprised. why do your clients continually return to you to your products or your services? And finally, what are the specific needs of your clients that your products or services will fill for them? This permeates everything. Accentuate and boldly proclaim your distinctness to a specific audience. You have to stand out. When you narrow your focus, you increase your appeal. Now, a final application for our discussion on persuasion, and I'm going to highly summarize this. There's more detail in your outline. What's your niche? In other words, who specifically do you want to persuade? Niche is about marketing, not about specialization or expertise. It's to target market in order to direct energy and inform a specific conversation. So let's look at this just briefly from three perspectives. Avatars, ecosystems, and watering holes. Now, these terms are just to get your attention. Avatars are ideal collaborators. And these basically are ideal clients. And look at the different ways in your outline that these can be defined. Demographics, profession, business, transition, special interest. Think about the people who you already have connection with. This needs to be highly specific as parents of adolescent ADD kids, women, small business owners. Secondly, ecosystems, the broad network of avatar affiliations. These can be specific areas or businesses or markets, as well as the products or websites used. And finally, watering holes. The specific locations where a large number of avatars or ideal clients hang out. Where you cross paths, literally or figuratively, with potential clients. Go to the watering holes and listen carefully how they describe their challenges and their problems. Then address the challenges by your services or products using their language, not yours. Become an expert about your clients' experiences, needs, and challenges. And there's a list of some examples of watering holes in your outline. Now, I want to conclude by saying one thing. After all this about niche and ideal clients, there's a practical concept. Consider your lowest hanging fruit. That is, the people, the relationships you already have, people who know you, will refer to you and will become your clients. Referrals primarily come through relationships. Your existing contacts, referral sources, gatekeepers. Know the gatekeepers. I'm going to conclude with this story. Gatekeepers determine access and control to a whole portal of potentially qualified clients. For example, many, many years ago, when I completed my residency in psychiatry and joined the faculty of Baylor College of Medicine, I was one of seven new faculty. There were prestigious programs represented, some great people. We each wanted to develop a limited private practice alongside our faculty position. When I got my first referral, it was from the secretary of the department chairman. Well, I thought, of course, that's where people would go when they're new in town or if they're embarrassed to ask their family doc to recommend a shrink to the chairman of the most prestigious medical school in the region. So I personally went down to thank her. Next referral, same thing. Each referral, a personal follow-up, Christmas a gift. When our faculty group of seven met in the spring, each of them mentioned a disappointment in getting referrals. They had none to one patient, and they were all expecting, you know, to develop a decent practice. At that time, I had eight. The nurturing of referral sources, especially of gatekeepers. And remember this principle of commitment to yourself and to consistency. Practice the basics daily, especially after you're successful. True masters never stop practicing the basics. Now, there are so many things I wanted to cover. I apologize again. I ran out of time. Jot down any questions you have, and we'll begin there this next time. I want to respect our frame. And we're to stop at the beginning of the hour, and I apologize because I enjoy discussion more than what I say because I know what I'm going to say and I already agree with most of it. But let's pick up the discussion next time and begin right here with any questions or clarifications. or applications that you have or would like to ask about. Thank you all very much. I appreciate all of your energy and input. Bye now, and have a great rest of the week.